Well, I don't know whether this will encourage you any. I think it's cooler up here than it is downstairs. Does that help anyone? Tonight we have a rather tricky subject, so I suppose we might as well dive into it and hope that the warmth of the evening will not cause too much psychic fatigue at this time. We are working this evening to determine, if possible, the processes of the subconscious mind in relation to man, and as I termed it, nature, by which we mean those forms of life in which intelligence is possible, but which are not human, according to our understanding. In the last 25 years, we have tried to be very objective on the subject of the human mental activity. And the most concise statement to summarize the general conclusion is that mental activity is now regarded as a form of motion. It is tied with the concept of movement. And that therefore, thinking is a kind of qualitative motion. Not from a place to a place, although thought may direct bodily motion from a place to a place. But in itself, thought is a motion from a condition to a condition, from a previous state through a present exertion toward a subsequent condition. If, therefore, we regard the possibility of thought process being a process of motion, how does it differ from every other motion that we know in nature? Well, we observe that that kind of motion, which we term intelligence or intellectual motion, seems to be eccentric in one particular. Instinct can cause things to infinitely repeat themselves. But when, in the process of motion, from a previous toward a subsequent state, the moving object or the moving being is subjected to a crisis, to an unexpected or an unusual condition, then we begin to see traces of true mentation. Thus, we have come to assume that the mental processes are most easily distinguished when habitual procedures become inadequate and the individual is suddenly confronted by something new, by a problem not previously solved, or one certainly unexpected in the situation in which it arises. We immediately observe that under such conditions, the individual is capable of a kind of activity by which he increases the total intellectual substance of himself. He is able to do that which previously he could not do, or shall we say, previously he had not done, and about the doing of which he was previously unaware. Thus, emergency, or the challenge of the new and the unusual, these most clearly reflect and reveal the existence in man of a creating, solving, intellectual power or faculty. The question then naturally arises, is such faculty evident or present elsewhere in nature? If mentation is associated with motion, if it is in some way a flowing, and motion itself is purposed, and we must assume that motion is purposed, movement has to have reason. It has to fulfill a requirement, meet a need, express a desire. Things do not move simply for the sake of moving. They are moved for purposes or for reasons. And the Greeks began to study the substance of motion to distinguish between the types of movement that could be noticed as things self-moved or things not self-moved. Or things apparently motionless in the midst of motion. About the latter group, the Greeks themselves had serious misgivings. They doubted if anything was actually immovable, unless it might be deity itself, which could be immovable because inhabiting all dimensions, there was no direction in which it could move, being total life in itself. But if motion is in some way a proof of the presence of intellectual energy, then may we not advance the possibility that all motion, whether it be in animate things or inanimate things, reveals a certain amount of intelligence. The French Academy in the last century sought to discover the nature and substance of intelligent energy, and they finally came to the conclusion that energy did show certain rudimentary forms of intelligence. If we wish to assume that the materialist has a strong case, and that we can no longer depend upon spiritual overtones to explain man, then man's intellectual life must arise in his energy field. Intellect must be in some way a production of energy or a production of motion. Now we observe that in motion, all things moving are governed by laws of their kind. The flight of the bird is not merely an accident or an incident. The flight of the bird is the result of the coordination of innumerable factors. The bird is constructed in a way in which its flight is possible. It instinctively and inevitably becomes consciously aware of its own flight possibility. And whether it has any thought about the subject, we do not know. But at least it instinctively flies. And that there has to be a certain education involving mind potential would seem likely from the fact that the parent birds have to teach the young bird to fly, and that the bird resists this education to a degree and must gradually be indoctrinated with the rudiments of the kind of life to which it belongs, before it assumes the full responsibility for flying, which is its natural right. Also, we find that all types of creatures, we can say, possess instinct. But this instinct, in most instances, is more than the mere repetitive process of doing what has always been done. Most animals can react to emergency. Most animals show, if only to a rudimentary degree, the possibility of personal solution to problem. Perhaps they have to be heavily indoctrinated before this is possible. Certainly they do not as immediately rationalize as man does. But experiments with various types of animals, even reptiles and fowl, have indicated that these creatures can be taught, and they can be taught largely by the most common inducement that nature has, and that is the inducement for food. Thus, most creatures will learn to solve the riddle of how to supply themselves with the food necessary to live. And under the tremendous stimulus of need, they will develop ingenious capacities and abilities to gain this food. Experiments in comparative psychology have shown that birds, animals, reptiles, rodents are very easily taught certain procedures. Now, the psychologist points out that while the animal or reptile or bird can be taught, it then establishes a kind of habit pattern and will usually abide by that pattern, lacking originality or lacking the ability to work through the type of equation which distinguishes the human mind. There is, however, evidence to sustain the belief that in the animal kingdom there are advanced types, and that these types can gradually be trained or can be unfolded by various inducements until they reveal many of the mental aptitudes, abilities, and thought powers associated with the normal life of man, and can be given an intellectual existence equivalent to a 6 to 8 year old human child. Therefore, we cannot say that the intellectual faculty is entirely absent. Now, when we start working with less animate things, let us take almost any kind of structure you wish to consider. For example, plant life, which is still, however, more or less animate. But let's go back to minerals and the cleavage of crystals. In this procedure, there is a definite indication of law and order. We would be very unhappy indeed if any of the reasonable patterns of consistency upon which we have learned to depend should suddenly be reversed. The falling object reaching the ground. The experiments of Galileo with the pendulum. The various motions of the heavenly bodies. The inclination of the earth's axis. All of these kinds of things play a very large part in our lives, whether we know it or not. And we would be greatly dismayed if any of these procedures suddenly became eccentric or departed from their reasonable probabilities. We could be in serious trouble almost immediately if water did not consistently run downhill. This situation, however, has to do with motion. Now, what is it that prevents many of these motions from becoming eccentric? Presumably, the interaction of various factors. These factors working together seem to bind a particular form of life into a structure from which it cannot escape. Actually, however, we have no way of being certain that nearly every so-called lawful process in nature, any consistent methodology with which we are acquainted, any procedure that goes on through the ages, filling us with confidence that it will indefinitely continue, any such procedure may very well imply a motion with intelligence. We do not know that it does not. We assume that it does not. And we are against another subject of difficulty, even to the psychologist, although he is beginning to sense its implications. The only thing we can seek for in estimating the intelligence of other forms of life is the kind of intelligence which we ourselves possess. It is conceivable that there are other entirely different types of intelligence, that the tests of our intelligence may not exhaust that which can be considered the true expression of intellect, that what we have is a highly conditioned form of intelligence, we know. And as we study it more and more, we realize something else, namely that gradually what we call intelligence has been conditioned perhaps from an original pattern of instinct. Today, the intelligence of the average human being is not strictly his own. His intelligence is derived from a variety of factors and circumstances moving in upon him. For example, his intelligence might be seriously injured if his memory failed him. And yet memory and intelligence cannot be regarded as identical. What we call intelligence is often merely the folk way of solving a situation or problem. Less and less are we actually required to express individual intelligence. Thus we live in a comparative security resulting from common processes which we share together and about which we have a broad acceptance without understanding. Deprive man of all of these additional outside modifying conditions and block out of him the memory of them, leaving him only with a primordial group of faculties with which to work. And it is quite certain that his reflexes might not be at all what we assume they will be today. Thus, intelligence to us is schooled, trained, and educated. It is influenced by propaganda, advertising, promotion. Our minds are subtly, constantly impregnated with ideas that are not really our own, and about which perhaps we have very slight true knowledge. We see this more and more with the gradual disappearance of individuality. The great struggle of the person today is to retain his own individual position in mental existence, and he is having ever greater difficulty doing this. He is finding heavy penalizations on such procedure. The easy, the inexpensive, the efficient way to live today is in complete conformity with broad patterns of acceptance. This conformity is not true thinking. It is not really very different from instinct. Instinct perhaps arises in the blood of things, conformity in the experience of things. Instinct may be a pressure from within us, but conformity is a pressure from around us. And it is difficult to say whether instinct or this pressure constitutes the more lawful cause or dynamic behind activity. We must, generally speaking, accept the fact that the average person thinks only in emergency and gradually protects himself more and more against such emergencies as may cause thinking. Thus, in matters of originality, we have always a poverty in times where intellectual energy is not individually developed. We are style conscious. We are habit conscious. We allow other people to make up our minds in almost every detail for us. Perhaps this is a kind of collective thinking, but if so, what does it actually amount to? Is it essentially different from the collective type of thinking which perhaps made certain social existence possible to the savage, and also as instinct perhaps still dominates a large part of the animal and plant worlds? We know that plants have a certain ability to discriminate, to sense value, and that among other things they will struggle desperately to reach light, to reach nutrition, or to survive by adjustment to very difficult situations. Thus, survival, in one way or another, seems to drive all things on. And the primary motion in nature is the motion towards survival, towards continuance. This a will to live. Now, can a creature totally without mentation have the instinct to survive? This has been a very moot question. Whether, for instance, the little vine that struggles out of the dark cave and finally manages to throw one feeble branch into the light where it can secure a necessary form of life, does this little plant know that it is striving to live? Perhaps it does not know. If it does not know, is this important? Does the fact that it does not know its own motive detract from the intellectual validity of the action? If so, where does this leave man? How many human beings know what they think with? How many human beings can actually give an absolute definition of mind? None up to the present time. How does any individual explain his own thought processes? How much do we know about the basic and rudimentary motives or instincts or impulses which we seek to gratify? The plant struggling to orient itself in an unhelpful or almost impossible situation struggles to survive. We say it isn't intelligent because it doesn't know why it is struggling. Man is struggling to survive. Does man know why he is struggling? If you had to sit down today and decide in your own consciousness why you are doing what you are doing today in terms of a long-range purpose that is important, what would your own conclusions be? Would you have any reason that you could give for your immediate struggle to live a little longer? Why do you want to live a little longer? Is there anything important that you are doing? Is there any important reason for your continuance? You are seeking perhaps to do some common good. As a nation, we want to live a little longer. Why? What is the average American citizen's vision of what he can do toward the condition of his country 100 years from now? Has he any concept of such thinking? Or is he living completely in a series of motions, the substance and essence of which he does not understand very much better than other more primitive forms of life? Man can talk about these things more volubly than any other creature. But having talked, has he said anything? And if he does say anything, does he know what he is saying? These questions affect psychological thinkers and, by extension, philosophical thinkers, because as yet there's been no way of successfully differentiating between psychology and philosophy, and we sincerely hope they will never find one, because without philosophy to give it purpose and meaning, psychology will never solve the enigma of the human mind with which it is so profoundly concerned. The ancients were not aware of our utilitarian perspective on things, but they also had certain essential concepts which they held to be valid. To ancient man, particularly I'm thinking of the classical Greek culture at the moment, mind was a kind of psychic entity. Mind was a being. Mind was not merely a condition of physical energy. Mind was not a byproduct of function. Mind was a superior kind of creature inhabiting a body. The Greeks represented this in several ways. They conceived at the root of things the existence of a universal mind. And this universal mind they regarded, if not as deity, at least as one of the primary attributes of divinity itself. The universal thinker was the demiurgus, or formator of the world. A universal mind moving from itself, accomplished all of the works of creation purposefully. These works were according to the mind of God, according to the will of God. There was at the root of all life intellectual purpose. The nature of this purpose might not be immediately available to man. It was not given man that he could read the mind of God, but it was given to divine mind that it could know the workings of the parts of itself. Therefore, while man could not fully understand God, and God, representing the totality of mind, could understand or accept or differentiate, rationalize concerning the infinite diversity of creatures within its own substance or composed of its own nature. Thus, a mind apart from matter, but forming a partnership with matter under certain conditions, was to a large degree the classical man's approach to the psychological problem. And as we go on today, digging more deeply into mental phenomena, we are becoming more conscious of its profundity, less inclined to regard it merely as an incidental part of physical phenomena. Even the modern psychologist of the Western school, who is not particularly given to abstractions, has become amazed and intrigued at the dimensions and proportions of the mental universe. He is discovering, for example, that whereas he thought the physical world was a great and wonderful place with almost infinite opportunity for research and consideration and, unfortunately, for exploitation, he has discovered that the mental world, as it is unfolding to his consciousness today, is infinitely greater than the physical world, that it has infinitely greater potentials. But instead of it merely being a fragment of something, it is far more complete, far more all-embracing than the physical life with which he has previously been concerned. It is now dawning upon him more and more that physical existence is the consequence of mind in action. Instead of the mind being a byproduct of irritation and the cerebral nervous system, what we call mind, is really the cause of the nervous system, that behind physical matter is this tremendous impulse, a rational, reasonable, conscious impulse, that this impulse projects body, that evolution is not the growth of form, but the growth of mind through form. That growth is not really merely the expansion of body, but the unfolding or ideating of energy. That the plant that is unfolding its leaves is bearing witness to flowing energies. That everything that we have previously regarded as purely physical is suspended from a life principle. And psychology has become intrigued with the possibility that this life principle is best understood as mind. Unfortunately, however, we are at another impasse. We are moving in the right direction, but we are too much inclined to love the idea of finality. Each new discovery we make is ultimate, and we have to reform and revise our thinking periodically. Even though we finally lift the veil of matter and discover mind, we must yet lift the veil of mind, because we certainly have not come to the end of our search for these sovereign realities that are at the root of existence. Mind explains many things, but the more we explore mind, the more we realize we need something else which will explain mind. At the moment, we're not too concerned with this, because we're having too much trouble and too much excitement analyzing mind. But by degrees, we come into the continuous realization that mind can also be sick. And we have a new perspective. the idea of the mind being responsible for many of the forms of sickness that we have previously assumed originated in the body, and that health is more a psychosomatic problem than we've ever previously realized. If, therefore, we assume that mind can be distorted, can be sick, we come a little bit in the direction of Buddhism. We come to Buddha's basic affirmation or thought, namely that you cannot trust mind any more than you can trust body as a solution to all mysteries. We really believe that when we understood body, we would understand man. This has not proven to be true. We now finally hope that when we understand mind, we can explain man. This will not be true. When we understood body, we explained body and needed something else. When we understand mind, we will explain mind and need something else. And this has always been the human experience in the search of knowledge. Actually, at the moment, we are already beginning to sense that mentalism as a science, that this science of attributing everything to mental phenomena, is beginning to weaken. That it is already showing distinct indications of insufficiency. We are gradually being forced to come back to the old terms that we hoped to discard long ago. We have to begin to think now of the possibility of a spirit or a consciousness behind mind. We have to realize that if mind can be sick, that the health of the mind must be assured by something superior to itself. That if the mind can be caused to depart from law and order, then the mind is not law and order. If the mind is capable of deviation from the reasonable, then the mind and the reason cannot be regarded as identical. If the mind can disobey truth, then mind is not aware fully of the nature of truth. And truth itself is greater than the mind. We have already come to the rather distressing opinion that with the mind we are not going to discover truth for the reason that it lacks the faculties and the experience breadths and depths by which it can experience totality. And what it cannot experience, it cannot know or define. Thus the mind becomes, again, a link or a stepping stone to something else. And we have to go further and deeper in our search for the true explanation of things. In the quest, however, for a solution to our mental life, several schools of psychology have come into existence, each with somewhat different attitudes, each with somewhat different findings. And these differences themselves remind us that where difference of opinion can exist, absolute fact is not yet attained. For had we actually the truth, we could no longer be in a state of uncertainty or conflict or opinion. The reason we are in opinion is that the fact is not actually commonly available to us. The various types of consciousness with which we have gradually come to be concerned may be divided in several ways. We'll use one very simple division now, which will serve the present purposes adequately. We can say we have a conscious mind. That is a mind that is focused on the level of objective awareness. It is the kind of mind in which there is no mystery. At least there is only one mystery and we never worry about it. And that is the mystery of why it's there in the first place. But the common conscious mind is that with which we can reasonably explain things. It is the mind with which we commonly know things. It is the mind with which we daily live. There is nothing too mysterious about it. For instance, we have a certain attitude. We wonder why we have the attitude, and the moment we wonder, we realize that we read it in the paper or that a friend told us, and we know how we came to possess this particular opinion. Or we can trace the functions of this mind to adequate antecedent causes. And we also can assume with reasonable certainty that its consequences will be consistent with its present directives. Thus we have no mystery, no great problem. But then there is another part of mind with which we are not nearly so familiar. And that is a mind which seemingly locked within us and below the threshold of our common experience, seems to throw constant pressures into our lives. This kind of mind is full of mystery, because it causes us to do things we do not understand, and often to do things we do not want to do. It contains within itself depths which we cannot easily fathom, and frequently results in temperamental, personality problems which almost frighten us. It is in this part of thinking that we suddenly realize that we do not know why we do what we do. We do not know the moment in which some further excess, some unexpected, even terrible thing may arise within us. But there is a kind of thinking which we cannot control, which arises spontaneously within us. And that this thinking is, for the most part, somewhat less on a moral and ethical level than our common conscious thought, as we are generally aware of it. We have a good many examples of this, and in this particular problem, psychological and psychical things seem to come very close together. We observe what has been psychically referred to as obsession, in which it seems as though another being or another personality takes hold of us, and that we seem to, in most instances, find ourselves in servitude to a pressure, a kind of being that is inferior to our normal selves. It is not uncommon to have cases come in of individuals who regard themselves as proper moral persons. Yet under the certain pressures of these obsessional situations, morality disintegrates. These individuals become crude. They become dissipated, profane. They become guilty of conduct which outrages their normal and natural attitudes and sensibilities. Yet apparently they have no power to control these pressures that move in upon them. Nearly always it has been observed that where these pressures move in, that they are inferior to the total personality. They represent apparently fragmentation within the personality, in which certain parts only manifest themselves. And these parts are not equal to the total personality from the standpoint of ethical or moral or spiritual levels of achievement. So out of the mystery of it all, and out of thousands of years of observation and reflection relating to myths, legends, symbols, ancient allegories and experiences, the fairy tales, the folklore, all these things, there has come a strong realization that there is within man a kind of subconscious mentation, something that represents a different level from that with which he is commonly acquainted. That this level is very difficult to bring under the control of the conscious mind. And that into this background, as into some filing system, into some deep closet of remembrances will be stacked away innumerable impulses and instincts which are not commonly drawn upon, but perhaps through the kind of associationalism attributed to the Mills, certain present conditions can force the subjective material into objectivity, temporarily at least, It is as though the mind had a strange remembrance of attitudes and qualities and draws forth out of its own recesses ghosts like those that haunted the castles of medieval Europe. So man has a ghost world within himself. And this ghost world, which is behind the threshold and below the threshold of his ordinary living and thinking, can involve itself in his conscious affairs very much to his detriment, particularly if he develops strong neurotic or frustrational tendencies. All this we more or less recognize and know, and I've only tried to summarize it briefly, because we have another purpose, really, which we're going to get around to presently, and that is to analyze as much as we can certain of the procedures that are now in popular use or in popular usage to solve these psychological phenomena. For example, we are told today in psychology that one of the most important things is to ventilate, is to bring up this submerged or concealed material and achieve a certain psychological catharsis. But we must get these frustrations out into the open. If we can only move them into the open by preventing them from continuing to build up within the individual, then we can, to a very large measure, help to restore his normalcy. In other words, the great struggle today is towards an extroversional state. Now, this is a charming thought. It's wonderful to live in a world of extroverting people, but it can be a little complicated. And I think the complication arising from our present psychological position and involving much of our educational program and considerable of our industrial and general social context, that this is wrong, that we're getting into serious trouble. Actually, the solution to man's problem is not extroversion. I cannot see how we're going to solve this by every individual doing everything he feels like doing, because most of the things that he feels like doing have not been very good up to now. Another point is that most of his frustrations, his neuroses, and his difficulties have arisen from doing what he wanted to do, regardless of whether it was wise or not. Mistakes got him into trouble, and the continuation of mistakes will not get him out of trouble. It certainly is not desirable to lock the person into a strong, frustrational position in which he will simply continue to be neurotic. What the individual profoundly needs, and what he is not getting, as far as I'm able to observe in any adequate measure, is what might be termed basic psychological education. He needs to know a lot more about himself, and he needs to recognize the importance of governing himself. It isn't catering to himself that is going to restore him. It is learning to become the active director of his own conduct. And this is what, up to now, psychology is not doing. The result is it will take a person with a frustration or a neurosis or a complex and will perhaps take a year or two, maybe longer, in an effort to work out this problem. Very sincerely, very honestly, tries to bring the individual into a better adjustment with his own inner life. But the trouble here is twofold, however. First, the average patient will not stay long enough with the practitioner to get a complete recovery, even from the problem he is at present suffering from. And in the second place, this specialized treatment of a specialist or a situation does not actually equip the individual to cope with other situations totally different, which may arise at any moment. The great need is for a solution to the basic problem of the problem, rather than an attempt to solve individual problems by themselves. The individual is much in the position of the man in medical school. He works at first from charts, and he learns where all the structure and organs of the body are located. Then he performs his first dissection and finds nothing is where he thought it was going to be. He cannot develop a sufficient theoretical knowledge to enable him to solve all of his problems without certain recourse to essential facts. And in psychology, essential facts are abstract and difficult to test. And it is very essential that the search be made for them with all diligence. When the child, for example, is being brought up under the new psychological attitude of being a complete extrovert, the family is no longer able to endure the child. Neither is the neighborhood in which the child lives. The child that is undisciplined is a misery to itself and a misfortune to others. Now, we would think the people observing this would then take a greater interest in their adult relationships with discipline. We would begin to suspect that mature persons would say to themselves, the good life is the disciplined life. It is not important that I gratify every impulse and every instinct that I have, because this program of constant and continuous gratification is habit forming. And when it is continued long enough, it destroys all determination, all inclination, all regard for discipline. Today we are gradually becoming one of the least disciplined people on earth. And as a result of that, our resources in emergency are strongly affected, in this case, adversely. If we wish to assume that there is within the individual a subconscious nature which is a bit of a reprobate, or certainly with strong inclinations toward delinquency, which most people must, under pressure, admit to be the case, then the problem is the re-education of this internal life. How did we make it in the first place? How did we get an interior nature full of frustration and full of negative circumstances? The materialistic psychologist will tell that one of two causes had to be responsible, either heredity or environment. The hereditary factor is open to considerable consideration and discussion. Environment, perhaps, can be regarded as a strongly modifying factor. In fact, some schools are satisfied merely to base their entire case upon the importance of hereditary modification or direction of conduct. All right, let us assume that the adverse influences of childhood, the circumstances of the broken parental home, the failure of intelligent guidance, indifference to child needs, perhaps poor nutrition, perhaps all of the neurotic and psychotic pressures of adults moving in upon the child. All of these things help to make the child sick. Now, if we wish to assume all this, we come to a dangerous situation as the child grows up. We have written an elaborate bill by which we have justified this child in being impossible. We have made it obvious to the child that its conduct is not its own fault, that it is a victim of circumstances, that it is rather well headed for disaster, in spite of anything it may do. There is, of course, the prevailing possibility that if this child, now grown to adulthood, and being the victim of his ancestors, is willing to further be a victim, but to the tune of several thousand dollars for therapy, he may in time work out of this ancestral complex. It may take him years. He may have gone through many tragedies before he even discovers that such a correction is indicated or possible. I am quite convinced that in our philosophical system of thinking, our basic understanding of man, that this procedure is not sound. There are cases where it can be used effectively. But to trust the entire hope of the final mental normalcy of our race upon this concept is not wise. We've got to get into this matter a little further. I think the Chinese have a good deal of information to give us.
If, for example, a child can be adversely affected by environment and be conditioned by forces moving in upon it, the adult in later life can in various ways affect its own internal life in the normal and proper courses of living. If wrong attitudes have made us sick inside, right attitudes can assist us to correct this sickness. Now, we were not made sick under the supervision of a physician. Our bad attitudes were not carefully calculated for us. We just accumulated them, gratifying our own habits and attitudes and desires. Actually, therefore, the correction is not necessarily a matter for a trained person. The correction is the individual's ability to recognize his own faults and do something about them. He knows more about himself than any other person can know. It will require hundreds of hours of analysis for a good psychologist to find out as much about an individual as he actually knows himself, if he is willing to admit it. I've talked to a great many persons in trouble who blame their condition upon ignorance, but when you sit down and study through with them, the average person knows what's wrong with him. He also knows why he's in trouble, and he knows it's his own fault. These things he does not want to admit under normal conditions, but in professional relationships he will frequently admit this. This being an admission which he will make and can make, his remedy and his correction lie within his means. It is a problem of the re-education of the attitudes and practices by means of which he got himself into trouble. This means almost certainly that the individual has to take over the administering of his own life and thought. He says, all right, well, how am I going to do this? Is it necessary to have a very elaborate formula for such remedying? I do not think so. The average person is not psychologically sick because of strict adherence to a formula. His psychological difficulties are due to a heterogeneous series of factors which have transformed his inner life into something of a mess. It is therefore perfectly possible for him to gradually reorganize his inner life, straighten it out by recourse to certain values that are available to him. One thing that he has to recognize is personal responsibility for conduct. It was his own effort that got him into trouble. It is his own effort that got him where he is. And it is his own effort that must result in the remedy or improvement of his state. He gradually worked himself into a disaster. The answer lies that he must gradually work himself out of that disaster. He requires no more than the ordinarily available knowledge of his kind, unless he has reached a point in which he is mentally diseased and must come under the general heading of psychiatry. But for psychological difficulties, in their various stages of development, the individual can, if he so desires, solve most of them for himself with the instruments and tools generally available to him. Now, there are two important instruments with which he can operate. One is religion and the other is philosophy. Both of these are of great antiquity, and both of them were calculated originally in their natural way to meet the very problem with which he is confronted. Man's religious and philosophic life has been autocorrective to his personal neurotic tendency since the beginning of recorded thought. Nearly always you will find the worst-oriented individual is the one in whom philosophy and religion are deficient, or in which they have been perverted to fanaticism of some kind. A person with a strong, solid, honorable, spiritual, or philosophical conviction is seldom out of his depth. It is therefore the general decline of man's spiritual life, particularly his philosophical insight, that we can at this time observe the rapid increase of his psychological difficulty. Psychology has become powerful and important in a century in which man's spiritual and philosophical values in the West have constantly and consistently declined. This means that man, in neglecting the development of his own internal life, has made himself subject to sicknesses of neglect. When he neglected hygiene, he was subject to the plagues. When he neglects mental hygiene, he will be subject to the peculiar plagues that result from this form of neglect. And unless he takes hold of the situation himself, he cannot really achieve a solution. Religion attacks one of the most basic problems of psychology, and that is fear. Fear is present in a great many, an overwhelming number of cases where psychological pressure is present. Fear is man's lack of personal confidence. Fear is the individual's sense of futility, the sense of the magnitude of the circumstances around him and the inadequacy of himself. Fear, philosophically, cannot exist in any nature in which there is a strong statement of values. Fear can only come where faith is weak. And if faith is strengthened, fear is weakened. Thus, in the basis of all of our internal sense of normalcy, we must have this victory of positive faith over negative fear. How shall we achieve this in our common experience in life? We must achieve it, perhaps, through re-education of values, through reorientation of our own attitudes toward life. Confucius gives us a rather interesting and important guide to the solution of our problem. He points out that the great trouble with most persons is that when they desire education, they choose a subject and master it, thus gaining insight into a subject. Having gained this insight into the subject, they then become distinguished as an exponent of the subject and remain miserably ignorant in everything else. The result is that we have the great philosopher, intellectual philosopher, who simply does not know how to make a living. We have the great artist who cannot get along with his relatives. We have the successful businessman who cannot get along with himself. We have the person who attains to great rational understanding but is never able to control his own temper. All of these eccentricities, these inconsistencies, are the result of the individual attempting to master subjects instead of attempting to master his own relationship to life. Instead of mastering a particular theme, it is first necessary for him to master the principle of learning. The beginning of the secure, normal life of man is the attainment of what Confucius calls the superior state. The superior man, according to Confucius, is simply one in whose life the performance of an inferior action is impossible. It's not a case where he's fought it out with his own conscience and won. It's simply impossible, because the instinct to inferiority has ceased. And by the instinct of inferiority, we mean the instinct to live below the level of recognized value. How then would you attain to this particular desired state of recognizing value, of becoming the superior person? The future.